Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. My name's Ron Candlars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland and Western Australia. With me in the Pod Booth studio is the Geo8 CEO, Vicky Thompson. And today we'll be discussing the upcoming federal election and what appears to be a fundamental change in Australian politics, the shift away from both major parties to others, such as Teal candidates, One Nation, the Greens, the United Australia Party, the list goes on. Joining us online is Nicholas Biddle from the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods, Professor Annika Goya from Sydney University, and Professor Rosalind Dixon from UNSW Sydney. Well, firstly to you, Nicholas Biddle, I know you have to leave reasonably soon, but you've released a poll that suggests that cost of living is the big issue as far as the federal election is concerned, but it has some other interesting results as well. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, so we surveyed about 3,500 Australians right at the start of the election campaign. And you're right, so a little under two-thirds of Australians said for them that cost of living was the highest priority in terms of whatever future governments there might be. And that's probably not a huge surprise that it's kind of top of the list, but the fact that so many people are concerned about cost of living issues and that they see it as a responsibility for government, I guess, is quite important. And also across our survey, other kind of measures are corroborating that. So since we've been doing a number of surveys since the start of COVID and just prior, and we find the highest proportion of people since the start of COVID who say that their income isn't sufficient to kind of meet their expenditure. We also find a pretty high proportion of people who think that prices are going to go up more next year than they went up over the previous year. So, combined, there's a lot of people who feel that for whatever reason, their income has not kept up with their expenditure, which obviously includes both what they're spending money on and also the price of those goods. The other interesting thing which we found was that aged care and fixing the aged care system was the second top priority amongst voters. And even though kind of not only a small proportion of people at a particular point in time are using the aged care system, people either know themselves will need to draw on the aged care system at some stage soon or are caring for someone who will or a family member. And you know, there's the Royal Commission recently, there's been the ongoing challenges with vaccinations and infection rates from COVID in the aged care system. And that kind of, it's clearly impacting on people and their views on what government should be doing. And just one final point is that for most of the top priorities, it was kind of things which affect them. So cost of living, aged care or education, you know, very kind of bread and butter type issues. But more than half of the population said that kind of dealing with global climate change should be the next government's top priority or one of their top priorities. So, you know, a breadth of measures, but also some which are kind of beyond, you know, more global issues and kind of reflective of Australia's need to contribute to kind of climate change issues.
Vicky, I think you had a few questions as well.
I was just interested that the cost of living rate's really high, but budget and immigration didn't rate. And so immigration, we can, well, maybe understand, although they are interlinked. Why do you think there's that sort of disparity with not raising the budget as an issue and relating that to cost of living?
Reducing the budget deficit is quite abstract. It gets a lot of attention amongst kind of political parties and kind of back and forth about who'd be better at reducing the budget deficit when it should occur. But I think what people what people tend to care about is well, what does that mean for them? If the budget deficit or if expansionary fiscal policy is contributing to interest rate rises and there's a tension between monetary and fiscal policy, or if it's leading to inflationary pressures, then people care about it. But if it's directed towards policy areas which, you know, people see as being quite important, so things like aged care, early childhood, the NDIS, things which are likely to impact on people directly or their family, then kind of the that's what's more important. And I think both the opposition and government, while they do talk about the budget deficit, I think for the general voter, it's more important for there to be a focus on, you know, how much, what taxes are they paying, what's that money being used for, and is that efficient in meeting their priorities?
So you're saying that the concept of debt almost getting to $1 trillion is more of an abstract idea to voters, whereas those other things that impact on their daily lives are the things they're really picking up on as they go to the election?
I don't think many people kind of talk about budget deficits that often. What they do talk about is, well, can we find a place for, you know, their mum or their dad or whoever needs to access aged care services, or are the services kind of up to scratch, or is the government doing enough to reduce the inflationary pressures which people are feeling? And when we ask people about kind of their expectations on prices, it's clear that's not abstract. That's kind of people experience paying for petrol, paying for imported goods or whatever, or houses or whatever's within that person's kind of main expenditure. So I think those are the things which matter. And certainly budget deficits are important, and managing and making sure that the money is being spent efficiently and that it's not contributing, it's not kind of pulling in, there's not tension between different arms of government. But that's not the way people view the issue. It's more viewed through the lens of what does this mean for me, my family, and my community.
Can I just ask, you know, I understand that you also looked at voting intentions based on candidate characteristics, and yep. Women candidates have come in strongly, and we're going to hear a bit more about that from our other guests. The vast majority of the teal candidates are there being known, or the Climate 200 candidates are, yep, women. Do you see any connection between what you've found and that shift, or at least what looks to be a shift away from the major parties?
Yeah, so look, I think the data, both our survey data, when we've run kind of more kind of experimental data, and when you actually look at voting patterns, there's absolutely no evidence that are female candidates in any way viewed negatively by the community, and it, more so it appears to be the alternative, which is that a female candidate is respondents are more likely to say they'll vote for a female candidate than a male candidate, and I think the major parties and particularly the coalition has struggled to have female candidates in winnable seats. And therefore, there is a gap there. And clearly, people don't just vote based on the gender of the candidate. There's a whole bunch of other things which factor into the decision. But if one of the major parties is not putting a sufficient number of female candidates in winnable seats, then it's likely to come at the cost of their ability to form government. And you're right, the independents have, not exclusively so, but for the most part, and certainly the ones which are creating the most media interest, have been female candidates and have clearly kind of created interest and engagement in the electorate, which has not happened in the past. And I think our data kind of supports a challenge for particularly the coalition to match that and to have a candidate list which better reflects the community which they're trying to serve.
The other thing I noticed too is with the numbers that you mentioned in the poll, the Greens vote had gone up slightly, other independent numbers had gone up. It was roughly around the 27% mark.
Yep.
So we're looking at that, close to 30% of others. And this is a shift away as well. For both of the major parties, there seems to have been a drop in their primary vote and an increase in this predominance of, as you say, female candidates and independent candidates. We are looking at some sort of major shift in Australian politics, aren't we?
Yeah, look, I think it's been a gradual trend, obviously, that over the years, the primary vote of the two major parties has declined. I know it varies. You know, there's years where one of the parties is for whatever reason able to kind of buck that trend. But over the long term, certainly a movement away from the major parties as first preference. And the way our political system works, it's clearly, it benefits the major parties in that you can have a party like the Greens, which gets quite high support across a number of electorates, but struggles to get more than one seat in the lower house. But it is getting to the point where it's, for many electorates, the Greens or the minor parties or the independents, even if they don't get into parliament, they're at the very least the second kind of candidate. And that not only impacts on what the makeup of the parliament looks like, but also the debates which are occurring in those electorates. So it's pulling the debate more towards the issues which the independents and the Greens Party are focusing on. And that can only be a good thing, regardless of your views, I think, on the major parties or on the minor parties. Having a diversity of discussion, having a diversity of views, and having a debate which better reflects the priorities within the community, I think can only be a good thing.
So do you have a prediction based on the data that you've gathered?
No, I'm an economist, and
they all have opinions.
They have opinions, but not predictions. What's the phrase? Give me five economists, and I'll get 10 opinions.
Exactly.
I'll sit on the fence with this one. All I would say, though, is that the issues which people see as a high priority, the voting intentions this late in the election, the preferences for candidates, all of that points to a very, very difficult election for the coalition, and something dramatic would probably need to occur for those undecided voters to go for the coalition and for enough people to switch their intentions. It's not impossible, and you wouldn't write off any of the major parties at any electorate, any election, but I think at this point in time, I would be more worried if I was leading the coalition than if I was leading Labor or the Greens, for that matter, who I think are certainly in a good position to improve their position within Parliament.
To you, Professor Annika Goyer from Sydney University, your work has looked at the operation of political parties and their ability to represent diverse and conflicting interests. It seems that the major parties are finding it harder and harder to do so, given the drop in their primary vote. What's going on here?
Well, I think that what's happening at the moment, and this is quite an unusual election because we've got a confluence of different factors at play here, is that the general trends in support for the major political parties over time, as Nicholas mentioned, also sit within the broader backdrop of declining trust in parliament, in political institutions, in democracy in general. And so there's been over the last sort of decade or so, I think, a real realignment in politics in terms of people's trust in parties as institutions, parliaments, and also their trust, I suppose, in the political system more generally. And at the same time, a fragmentation towards different avenues for participating in politics, social media and media commentary coming from many, many different angles. So this sort of bigger picture of trends in the nature of politics and participation itself is making political parties, the job for political parties, very, very difficult because they haven't been great at adapting to long-term policy challenges, as Nicholas mentioned. They are very much stuck in the sort of this idea of society and these ideologies that existed in the first half of the 20th century, but don't reflect the changing nature of work today, the diversity of our society. So they're having problems meeting people's expectations in terms of policy. They're also having problems meeting people's expectations in terms of the way they operate internally. So we had a period in Australia post-Second World War where we describe them as mass parties. They had lots of members that had sort of clear social roots in the electorate. And those are days that are long, long gone, not just here, but elsewhere in the world. parties really struggle to attract members. They struggle to attract people who engage and participate in their activities. And has already been mentioned, they struggle to attract high quality, diverse candidates. And the underrepresentation of women within political parties is really good evidence of that.
The other thing that strikes me when you mentioned social media, are we in an era now too where the algorithms mean that, you know, when we communicate on social media, we communicate in this bubble and we communicate as tribes with those like-minded people. So when it comes to getting a bigger picture that embraces all the other nuances of particular big issues, it's really hard to do so. People are locked into specific ideas, specific ideologies about the ways to rectify society's problems.
Yeah, I certainly think that's a danger of social media, though I'm really not sure that I suppose that there was a heyday of political communication that operated in a different sort of way. So when we think about the role of the mainstream media throughout the decades, they've always been a very, very strong voice in directing political opinion, and that continues to today as well. So I think it is very much about the diversity and creating different ways of allowing people to express their opinions. So social media can be a positive in that sense as well. One of the things that we can do and we need to do as a society looking forward is to think about how we can shape the nature of political and electoral debate to make sure that diversity of voice is guaranteed. And this is where very concrete things like political finance reforms come in, like ensuring that we have transparency in our electoral processes and around political spending and money in politics, and also making sure that we've got arenas where freedom of speech is protected in an appropriate way.
You talked about a trust deficit. I mean, that's a global phenomenon, isn't it? It's not peculiar to Australia. And I would assert also that that trust deficit extends to institutions. And in fact, we've gone through a period where even universities and academics and scientists have been questioned in relation to the evidence that they're providing, not just in a political context, but more broadly. So I'm just wondering whether or not you've got any examples of other countries where we've had this kind of shift, it seems, a shift away from the major parties to the independents, which it looks looking like where we might be heading on the 21st of May.
We've seen examples of other countries embracing shifts away from major parties to other sort of political groupings. So I think some really interesting stuff happened in Southern Europe, in places like Spain around the global financial crisis, where we saw movements like Podemos. They really tried to articulate a new way of doing politics where citizens could participate and experts could participate in the political process away from these major party groupings. But certainly the independent phenomena in electoral politics is something that is actually quite unique to Australia. And this makes the 2022 election a really, really interesting one from a comparative perspective, because what has preceded the Teal Independence and the Climate 200 grouping are the Voices For movements. And this started with Cathy McGowan in Indi and currently continues with Helen Haynes. But we have seen a number of different Voices For movements really gaining ground in the last 2 years, 18 months or so. And it's this community-based organising where the community establishes some priorities for itself, seeks community opinion, also works with experts in that context to then develop policies and support candidates running for election. That's something that is quite unique, and Australia is a leader in that model of organising for political change.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, this diversity of opinion, and Nicholas was saying before that, you know, it's a good thing that this is reflected in our political system, but the major parties always look at the rise of independents and the Greens as potentially a problem, you know, that it weakens democracy, that it leads to volatility, it means that you can't deal with the big issues, etc. And yet it's democracy at work.
Yeah, I mean, there are two sort of types of democracy, two types of democracies across the world. Those where you have a strong adversarial system or a two-party system, what we call the majoritarian democracies, and the arguments that are always given in favour of those types of democracies is that when someone gets into government, it's decisive. that they can put the policies that they took to the electorate into action, into legislation. So it's a sort of a clean process, provided you have free and fair elections. The other type of democracy is more consensual, where we have a number of different political parties that make up the parliament. The issue there is that obviously it requires negotiation, compromise, and consensus, which is much more difficult to achieve practically. But the benefits are that we have a greater diversity of voices in the political process, and it also enables, you know, the diffusion of new policy ideas and arguably even better longer-term policy making.
So where do you think we're going with this election? Are we heading back to 2010, to a hung parliament and those other diverse voices having a fundamental say in the running of the Australian political system?
I think that there is potentially a real shift here. So at the very least, as Nicholas mentioned, what this is doing is that it's bringing issues such as climate change onto the agenda through the work of the independents and also the Greens. That you know, you think about the major parties' position on climate change, they're both pretty similar. They're trying to get to the same place at the same time, but with slightly different means. So we have that diversity there. In terms of what will happen in the next parliament, yes, I think that there is a real possibility that we're going to have more independents returned in the House of Representatives. So we may see a similar minority government situation as we had in 2010. And let's also not forget the Senate. I mean, for a lot of its history, the Senate has been accepted by the Australian public and also lauded by the public as a house of review, where that balance of power has actually been a good thing for democracy. We've had minor parties in there, independents, who have been able to provide a check and balance on the activities of the government.
To you, Professor Rosalind Dixon from the University of New South Wales, your work focuses on comparative constitutional law, constitutional design, constitutional democracy. Are we looking at a major shift in the way our democracy will function in the years ahead?
I think probably not. I think a realignment, but not a major shift. I think, you know, there could be a great deal of change coming out of this election if all the independents who are running get up. My guess is some will, and there'll be some real change, but perhaps not as seismic a shift as some are predicting or hoping. But, you know, the lessons of politics are everything is up for grabs. That's why we, you know, have to get involved and take every election really seriously. But my prediction would be this will be a realignment, not a major shift.
Yeah, there appears to be this drift, though, doesn't there, to these professional women in particular seats, key seats, the teal seats. How do you see that trend?
So, as you know, one of my other roles at the moment is director of the Pathways to Politics for Women program at UNSW in conjunction with the Trawalla Foundation. So on that level, I'm really excited to see it. One of our alumni of our program, Georgia Steele, is one of those independents running in the federal seat, Diffuse, against Craig Kelly. So on many levels, I think it's a hugely positive development. Those indications that Nicholas and you talked about the trust in female candidates, I think is, again, terrific and a sign that things are really changing. If I was wearing my cynic's hat, I would say these women are running to try and change the discourse. They're being good governance candidates. That's important. I think the real test is whether voters still like and trust women when they're doing the hard yards of government, making trade-offs, forming coalitions, compromising, putting principles into action. Often women are liked when they're sort of the good girl outsider and when they're the, you know, women at the table making the decisions, exercising real power, there's a bit more blowback. So I'm extremely optimistic and excited about the development, but how it plays out in terms of both our politics and our gender norms, I think is actually still an open question. And I think we need to be cautious about seeing progress where women are supported in the role of good governance outsiders as compared to power wielding, compromise making, policy driving, tough decision makers. That's where the gender norms get really tough. And I don't think we've seen yet how that's going to play out.
So how do you prepare through your Pathways to Politics program women for that bit? I mean, there's the, As you've quite neatly said, there's the hard yards of getting in. But once you're actually in that seat, and I will come to a question about universities because obviously I'm here as the chief executive of the Group of Eight and I'm interested in that policy. But there are very complex, vexed issues and pieces of legislation that all parliamentarians have to deal with. And the way that they are represented is sometimes, as you've quite rightly said, quite different. So can you actually prepare candidates for that?
Well, I think, Vicky, it's a great question. There's no preparing people for the lived experience of a role. You know, one of the great findings of social science of the last couple of decades is all the behavioural insights or social psychological findings about the fact that it's hard to imagine things. It's always different. You know, the difference between experience utility and decision utility is well known. But we try, and we try in a variety of ways by encouraging women, by encouraging them to think about what's at stake and their own power, their own passion and values and strengths, but also by hearing from a range of people who are in public office and who've left public office, who've succeeded, who failed, and who talk about the challenges. We talk about, you know, the hate people encounter in social media, the difficulties of making trade-offs between your personal values and your party if you're in a party, why being in a party is good and bad, all of those things, so that none of these things come as a surprise. And we're now developing a series of masterclasses for our women who did get elected in the local government elections in New South Wales in December and have already told us that it's more challenging than they anticipated. Mm. So, you know, you can't ever prepare people fully, but you can make them aware of what they're going to encounter. You can give them a sense of what the challenges are going to be, and then you can follow up. You know, mentoring is another part of what we do. Everyone who wanted a mentor from our program got one. And, you know, my big belief is mentors are a portfolio of supporters, and they're not always going to be exactly like you. One of our women who just got elected to the council in Orange was looking for a mentor, and I really couldn't find someone who fit all of her criteria. And I said to her, what about Adrian Piccoli? He's from a different party from you. He's a different gender, different generation, but he's a very experienced political operative who knows the regions and he's willing to step up and support you. And she got a lot of interesting advice from him. So mentoring, awareness, support, and, you know, being there to follow up in the journey. But it's very hard. And I think there's a certain degree of willful naivete on the current cohort of people and their supporters that things will be completely different. There's a lot of change that needs to happen to make Parliament more friendly to women and to people with caring responsibilities, to make our discourse less toxic, and to try and change some of the way we currently talk to each other, particularly on social media. I mean, I find the idea that if you say something that people virulently disagree with, the norm is now that you will get a death threat on social media, deeply distressing.
And this point of, I mentioned before about this notion of tribalism that sort of entered into politics, and we're seeing a greater fragmentation of the Australian political system with, 30% for both major parties and, you know, something similar for independents and others. Do we get to a point where it becomes very difficult to tackle some of the bigger picture items in Australian politics because there is this level of fragmentation and people will shy away from much needed grand reforms because you can get picked off?
I'm much more optimistic because I've lived in the United States for a long time, and everything compared to the United States looks harmonious and non-polarized. I was watching the first leaders debate with my daughter, and she said to me, "But Mum, they're so, you know, they agree so much. It's weird." And that's, of course, because she's a US-born political, young person. And I think that I still have a lot of optimism that Australians are willing to be sensible, listen to argument, come together in areas of need to both, you know, support the community and do the right thing. I think that there is polarisation. And I think the influence of US politics in that regard is troubling. And I think we shouldn't be complacent, but I still remain very upbeat about the degree to which bipartisan agreement around a range of values and principles around our social welfare state, gun control, good government, and evidence-based decision-making is really encouraging. I think the loss that we've seen in the last 15 years is a willingness to kind of cooperate across the aisle on a range of sensible reforms, and that's really disappointing. But I still think there's a broad centre in Australia that is reason-based, respectful, and capable of achieving real change. You know, if you want evidence of that, the NDIS was a topic of the first debate. Obviously, there are differences between the major parties about how they would fund and reform the NDIS. But Morrison says, you know, We admire the NDAs. It's a great achievement of the Gillard government. We just want to put it on a more sustainable footing. That is something you would never see in the United States, ever. That the Affordable Care Act, deeply popular in many respects, is something that the Republican Party is so bent on destroying because of the ideological divide and polarisation. So it's real, but I remain optimistic. And I think it's important not to be ahistorical. You know, go back in Australia and think about the divide in the Labor Party, the divide, you know, that was very real in Australian politics. I think the idea that tribalism is something new, if it exists in Australia, you know, you've got to look back, a few decades or more and see how deep some of those divides went that were religious as well as ideological and partisan. So yeah, it's real. It's something to worry about and grapple with, but I'm not as worried as I would be if I hadn't seen what it looks like elsewhere.
Not surprisingly, I'm very interested in higher education and university policy. And I think we've seen, well, not a thing, there has just, it's you know, crickets. We're hearing nothing on university policy. So I guess it's a question to both of you in relation particularly to the Teal candidates. So we've written actually just today to those candidates, just asking them, you know, what are your views on universities? What are your views on increases to student fees, which we've seen under the coalition government? What are your views on the fact that we've had cuts in funding to engineering, to, you know, the humanities, arts and social science? So students now are paying up to 93% of their degrees if you're studying a HAS subject. And I think it's important for us to actually ask those questions of those candidates. We certainly ask them of both the major parties, because the big focus has been around, for those candidates, climate change, integrity in politics. And I think Annika made the very good point about galvanising local community action. But as I think, Rosalind, you said, they're actually going to get into Parliament and have to deal with these issues. And in many ways, I think they're an unknown quantity in that regard. And so I'll be very interested to A, see if they actually respond, and B, what their response is. But I'm just wondering from both of you, why do you think it is that higher education, universities, we're just not resonating at all in this particular, in this election campaign?
My view is that, you know, certainly in relation to the independents, I think they have to have a clear sense of their priorities. If they have a policy on everything, it doesn't cut through. So it's not surprising to me that they're highlighting those couple of big issues plus community local issues. The good thing is most of those people are Australian trained professionals who are where they are because of the educational opportunities they enjoyed. And so I'm optimistic that if they're in the balance of power, they will give Vicky and other university advocates and leaders a good hearing, because they are, you know, you don't get to be a paediatric neurologist or a corporate lawyer without the benefit of a good educational system, and they're all beneficiaries of it, and I think they'll understand and appreciate that argument. So I'm optimistic. As to why this isn't cutting through more generally, I think two things. One is about leadership. I think both sides trying to run a relatively small target, cost of living driven campaign in which those big ideas about Australia as a green, knowledge, inclusive nation aren't being particularly focal. And the second is that I think that voters have come through a lot in the last few years. It's been a really tough period for families, for individuals, for households, for workers, for businesses. And in those circumstances, I think people are understandably wanting to hear about what are you going to do for me tomorrow? What's going to help me tomorrow? And education is about our future. It's a long-term investment in a better democracy, a better society, a more productive economy. We're university professors. We believe in what we do and how it makes a difference to our society and our economy. But the benefits of investing are long-term, and the failures to do so as well. And so I think this is a campaign where the leadership is very limited in terms of big ideas, but it's also an understandable moment where people want to understand, how do I afford petrol, groceries, how do I pay my bills and make sure that my family's taken care of? And I think that's an understandable post-crisis moment where people's focus is more medium to short-term rather than long-term. And I think, Vicky, that there are some signs that Labor has at least been willing to talk about increasing domestic student numbers, uncapping things. And I think that the sort of elephant in the room in this area is that our relationship with China is shifting tectonically. It's going to take a long time to shift back. That has very serious implications for the sector. But, of course, no one really wants to spell that out quite so explicitly for understandable reasons. Mm. So I think it's not actually a failure to appreciate the importance of public education, although that's there too. It's about the moment and the context. And I think whoever's in government next needs to be really pressed by not just those of us who work in the sector, but those whose children and businesses stand to win or lose because of the investments that are and aren't made, to really put that back on the agenda for government. And I'm confident that the independents, if they're there at the table, will help us do that.
I would just add that education, tertiary education and research has been a very difficult issue to get on the election agenda at any election, just because as Nicholas told us at the very beginning of the podcast, management of the economy, health, they're the big issues that pretty much every campaign is run on in Australia. So in terms of really getting governments to listen, the advocacy that's needed from groups like yourselves and from universities more generally, most of that work happens in between elections. But I think a larger public campaign around the value of, as Roz mentioned, that longer term value of universities in addressing the types of issues that the independents are exactly campaigning on is incredibly crucial. So if we think about climate change, universities are extremely well placed to deliver on the research and the application of the research that will enable us to tackle that problem. If we think about governance issues, integrity, universities are again well placed to deal with those challenges as well. So I think the appeal to the independents would be, we're working on the problems that you think are important. And so there should be a natural alignment there.
I think we'll have to leave it there. But to Nicholas Biddle from ANU, Annika Goya from Sydney University, and Professor Rosalind Nixon from UNSW, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an
great
amazing
discussion.
Chat to look into these emerging trends within Australian democracy. Thank you for your time. Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder, you can always tune in to Debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.